All right, welcome to The Modern. This is our Sundays with The Modern program, where we invite artists, art historians, writers, and architects to talk about work on view. And today it's my pleasure to introduce Peter Doroshenko. He's the executive director at the Dallas Contemporary. And before he arrived in Dallas, he was the president and artistic director of the Pinchuk Art Center in Kiev. He's held director and curator positions over the past 20 years, including at the Baltic Center for Contemporary Art in Gateshead, the Stedelijk Museum for Actuelle Kunst in Ghent, the Institute of Visual Arts in Milwaukee, the Contemporary Arts Museum in Houston, and the Everson Museum of Art in Syracuse. He's organized numerous one-person exhibitions over the last 15 years, including artists like Maurizio Catalan, Sam Durant, Andreas Gursky, Keith Haring, Pierre Wieg, John McCracken, and Mariko More. He's also written or contributed to several books and exhibition catalogs on artists like Dora Garcia, Joseph Havel, and Irvin Vorm. He's also recently completed a book on international private collections called Private Spaces for Contemporary Art. In 2007 and 2009, he was the commissioner for the Ukrainian pavilions at the Venice Biennale, and in 2010, he co-curated for the Busan Biennale in South Korea. Please join me in welcoming Peter Doroshenko.
Thank you. Thank you for coming out on a actually quite a miserable day. What I'd like to do is take a stroll through the galleries and touch upon some of the individual works. I think because of the nature of how we're set up here and we'll be moving in this direction, if at any point you have a question, that probably would be the best time to ask. So that way we can kind of continue the dialogue as we move through the spaces. And there are no silly or stupid questions. All questions are great because I am can guarantee you I'm not a Diebenkorn-esque expert whatsoever. I do know a lot about Diebenkorn's context in terms of California, abstract expressionism, almost touching into color field. And if you do have a question, we can all kind of share and connect in answering that question. So what I'd like to start out is basically what I just mentioned is that Richard Diebenkorn is truly, from my perspective, an American phenomena, almost to a certain extent of a California phenomena. He was extremely, had a very, very big impact on a lot of students from, I'd say, the mid-1950s until mid-70s. I mean, there was a real, I think, impact of his works, especially this series, which you're extremely fortunate to be here because this is his most known body of work. A lot of people talk about Richard Diebenkorn as a San Francisco Bay Area painter. I never really kind of thought that. I still see him as a California painter. Yes, he lived there, he did a lot of work there, but including this work, which is his most famous, there were times where he would leave California. And from my perspective, I see him creating these works in Santa Monica, and that aspect of San Francisco and then Santa Monica, you know, it's for Californians, it's a day and night scenario. And that's why I just kind of basically label him as somebody from the West Coast or from California. Now, he is somebody that really absorbed and was very, very good at information. And from my understanding and seeing now for the second time this exhibition and seeing Diebenkorn's for the last 30 years is that he's really, really taken the concept of improvement on a specific idea in modern art to a really high level. A lot of artists, including architects, always pull bits of information together, and I see him actually, to be quite honest with you, more related to a loose fragment of architecture than I do to very emotional painting. This painting is very formal, it's very structured, and I think he always was interested in this, the kind of formality that existed in the 20th century, and informed himself about that. Even though he had other interests such as Monet and Matisse, and actually even went to Europe to inform himself more so on what than what he'd seen in California or in New York, and then also even took one of the few who was able to get a visa to go to Russia, to the Hermitage, to see the collection of Impressionists. But I think, you know, he also was, you know, there. You see the works, you still have a lot of time. I'm sure he went and saw the Constructivists, he saw the Renaissance painting. He absorbed a lot of information. And what he was a master of is taking all of this information, all of these visual nuances and iconography, and putting it down into canvas. I think if you see any of these works that are before us, they're very geometric. There's a geometric play. Obviously, he is looking at a particular landscape, yes, but at the same time, he's also thinking about and expressing other issues, such as color, shape, and to a certain extent, something that's not really talked about is time, and the aspect of time in the shape and in the form and in the aspect of realizing the particular canvas. I think it was always fascinating, anybody who's fascinated by history, it's always, history is connected to time. And time is always painful, and so is history. Because, you know, you have the future, which is illusionary, and you have the present, which most of us don't want to live in. So we pretty much live in the past or in the future, and most of the time it's the past. And so it's a time-based kind of a component. And that's something that you constantly see in a lot of the work, and the aspect of compression in the particular shapes. And sometimes it's almost in certain canvases, like on top there and in other areas where a lot of the forms and kind of, you know, you have almost a monochromatic painting, and then everything is just jammed up and compressed on the top. Well, that's very much about this whole aspect of time. And to a certain extent, the aspect of playing off of space and form, once again, much like I see architects think through, not necessarily realize, but the way they think through and deconstruct a lot of ideas, including the aspect of time. So we can all go this way into this area. Now, in a painting like this, this is what I was talking about, that heavy information on the top, but these paintings are really aerial observations of parts of Santa Monica. I mean, they're really, if not direct, there's indirect kind of quotations. So basically, he's somebody who served in the army, had access to kind of various topographical information. Obviously, that's something that came into play when he left and pursued a complete studio practice. At the time, the aspect of landscape was changing dramatically in California. I mean, it was like the emerging state during the 50s and early 60s. Things that were once fields instantly turned into subdivisions, and subdivisions turned into, you know, small, large communities and cities. And so for him, that aspect of change was happening constantly. And the need to document and the need to put something down was very much there. But yet at the same time, it is, as you see with the lines, that the vertical lines that go up, it's completely different than his contemporary Barnett Newman. I mean, Barnett Newman was addressing something way in a different kind of a vernacular. But there is this aspect of using this kind of zip or horizontal as a road, as a kind of a visual signifier, dividing the green and the aqua color and kind of the rust color. And so it is, to a certain extent, a topographical scenario. It is, to a certain extent, an abstraction. It is, to a certain extent, many, many other kind of scenarios that he's involved with. And I read somewhere where there was an author who said that most of these works were realized out of the window of his studio. That's hard for me to believe. That sounds really great when you're reading it, and it sounds very romantic, but I really, really think that's ridiculous. For me, I see him being actively involved in visualizing, you know, the changing environment surrounding him. I see him gathering information such as kind of topographical photographs. And you have to understand that this is just literally 10 years later, something that there was another great painter in this building, Ed Ruscha, who also pursued this whole aspect of the landscape and topography and aerial visuals. And so this basically, it's combining all of that information. It's really him creating, finding his own voice and his own direction, which I think he was quite successful at. But yet at the same time, when you see the color, this is so unrelated to a lot of abstract expressionists. I think it's more of a play with color field, which was really more of an East Coast scenario. And these are people he came into contact with when he would take a trip to New York or go to museums. I mean, he was definitely aware of that whole process. And so to say art historically or to label him as one thing, I don't think is quite fair, because he was there, but he wasn't completely anchored in one scenario, nor do I think he wanted to be. He really didn't buy into any kind of a labeling process. And most definitely, you know, when you mention abstract expressionism, his name doesn't really kind of come up either. And so he's always been, you know, if I could say, a hybrid of sorts. And I think it had to do with the isolation of being in California. I think it had to do also, to a certain extent, of many, many other people, artists from California, including Ruscha. And I believe also that whole aspect of his travels, the absorbing of information, the contact he had with other artists, layering all of that information. These paintings are extremely layered. I would say much more than any Rothko painting or Barnett Newman, which were much more about the surface. Yes, these are about the surface, but there's a lot of information. I think because of the opaqueness of the painting, because it's not very heavy, you know, you're basically seeing, it's almost like, to a certain extent, a certain layers of transparent paper or curtains, or there's depth that you can read into the flatness that is just not the norm for abstract expressionism. And I think that's what sets him off. I think also the rigid geometry is also, to a certain extent, totally not Californian, but yet is. He was ahead of his time. And what I'm saying is, literally after Diebenkorn, and a major influence for many, many artists, was this kind of California cool school or conceptualism, that you have artists such as, you know, John McCracken and a series of John Good, and that whole kind of California school that really found itself, Tony DeLapp, that found a level of, well, they found their voice in the 60s. But obviously, this is something that they'd seen over and over again. For me, this work is much more closely related to a variety of geometric painters, such as John McLaughlin from California, than any of the East Coast abstract expressionists living in New York and kind of creating a network there. And so it really kind of, there is no place to put it, except basically that it fulfills many of the art historical components that we read on the wall, that we read in the catalog, which are truly, you know, it truly tries to kind of flush out and to inform us on who Diebenkorn was. But it's extremely layered. And, you know, reading the essay for this show, the more I read the essays, which were quite good, the more questions I had. And that's me as an art historian thinking, well, what about before? What about after? What was happening here? What really did occur in this particular time? So there is no right or wrong. There is no, it's kind of a center here. And the center was him as an individual. And I think what makes Diebenkorn extremely successful, and to have this work here, which is truly amazing, is that it was just Diebenkorn. He was his own island. And many, many artists, because of that, as I mentioned before, and I'm sorry I'm repeating myself, that isolation, that kind of focus in on the studio, they became their own entities. Because you have to understand that the abstract expressionism, for the most part, were in New York. They all went to the same place. They all ate at the same places. They all critiqued each other's work. They all partied in each other's studios. Not saying that they didn't happen for Diebenkorn, but not to the level of what was happening in New York City. It was extremely, extremely different. Diebenkorn is somebody who got up in the morning and went to the studio and painted. And so, you know, if that aspect of people coming over and visiting or critiquing or giving feedback, other artists, occurred, but rarely, because in California you have to drive everywhere. So it's not like you could just walk over or just drop into somebody or you bump into each other in the street. It just didn't occur. So the distances, you know, even in California, really created an isolation. And so when you, especially when you see this work in conjunction with others at the time, his contemporaries, it just jumps out. It doesn't make any sense. Yes, there are little bits and pieces that you can take a look at and go, oh yes, there's some similarities. Absolutely. I mean, it was the time. He was looking at different people. He was meeting people. He was reading. He was traveling, etc. But I think for the most part, he was his own man. Yes?
Did you see any relation to Hans Hoffman's work? I know they didn't cross paths in Berkeley, but Hoffman's influence may have persisted in Berkeley, that he would be influenced by when he was there.
Oh, absolutely. And I think he...
The layering aspect of the abstraction.
Absolutely. At that time, Alan Stone had a gallery where all this work would have been seen in New York, and Diebenkorn, when he would travel to New York, I mean, obviously, he would go... It wasn't like now where you go to New York and there's like 500 galleries. At that point, you know, there literally was like five for modern art at the time, like significant galleries. So it's basically a two-hour, you know, trip by foot in New York. And at the time when they would have an opening, I've been told that if 20 people came, it was quite a success. And because collectors didn't go to openings, it was usually just critics and other artists. So it wasn't really until the 60s that people informed themselves about, you know, became social. But for Diebenkorn to see the works, he definitely had seen what everybody else was doing at the time. There's no doubt about that. Yes?
Go downstairs and look at the this caused by Hoffman. I think it makes sure that is much more surface.
Mm-hmm.
I might be wrong about that. Do you agree with that, Dr. Hoffman?
What's that?
That the Hoffman seems like it's much more surface than an abstract expression as well.
Right, I thought he went out of his way to implant with the slabs dimensionality to his students.
But not transparency. Like, this has such transparency, which is what I thought you were pointing out.
Yes.
That his was an archaic quality to an abstract expression, or, I mean, to my eye, that's what I see. But you know what I'm wondering, Peter, if you could talk a little bit about, or if you even agree, that there's something in Buechhorn's work that seems to be resisting what he knows, or kind of at least struggling with what he knows about what's going on the East Coast, what's coming for him, and trying kind of to be in isolation and make something out of his own experience. But that, it seems like it just keeps coming back. I don't know, there's something in this work that I keep, after all this time, I keep thinking is unresolved, but I think that's a mystery. I don't think it's unresolved. I think it's just this sort of resistance to communication.
I think you are correct, and I think a lot of it has to do with this, you know, cliche of California Impressionism and the light and the context. I mean, living in Santa Monica, you have the ocean, the light is so different, you know, than 99% of the rest of the country. And I think the aspect of him when he would do the travels, when he would read, when he would see different images, is that it was literally impossible for him to paint that way in California. I mean, it's kind of like, you know, going to Mexico and speaking, you know, Lithuanian. Ain't gonna work, you know? And so the aspect of him, yes, maybe he was pulling back, but at the same time, he's not gonna take the brush and go heavy with the paint, such as Rothko would do, because there's no way to need that emotional mark to be made, as where here it's much more fluid, it's very much about the light, it's very much about the surroundings, the landscape, all of the history, you know, that, and to a certain extent, something that he was extremely always interested in, and I can guarantee you he probably saw as a child a ton in the museums, was the California Impressionism. And it's just all the museums there, because once again, the isolation, they really focused in on that. And so you didn't see Monet there. Very few museums did have that, really stopped at the Art Institute or the St. Louis Art Museum, and it just never kind of made it west. And so the kind of French masters of Impressionism, he actually had to deal with the second and third generation of Impressionists, and it was around him, and they also had a different palette. If you go, it's a very light palette. It's not like the French where they gobbed on the paint, and they had this kind of strange aura about the colors, and it's much more opaque. It's much more, and I can really kind of see that jumping in here. And so, yes, I think it's reserved to a certain extent, but I think, but I don't think it's overly thought through. I think it just may be a natural process from the environment and the situation he was in. Actually, move on to the next gallery here. I mean, for me, and I just want to very briefly touch this, and we can go into the next gallery, but I think having these drawings and then having this painting here are perfect, because, let's be honest, this really looks like a map. I mean, it really looks like an unfinished, kind of very shoddy map. And you see the geometry, almost like a topographical building forms, and the aspect of reworking the white space. It's really, and when an artist reworks a white space and actually leaves it kind of unfinished, there's a history there. I mean, it's he's doing it on purpose. And so this aspect of knowing that it was one thing, now it's another, then it's moving on, and it's kind of unresolved. Well, that's the way subdivisions and cities grow. One minute there's a building, then there's a fire, then it's an empty lot, then there's a new building, then the building kind of is decrepit over 40 years, then a new building's put up. And so basically we're seeing this kind of the changes in one painting, and yet at the same time you have the traditional iconography and language of the painting of that from that time all in one work. And so you have the color, you have the shapes, you have the forms, but he's trying to relate in a very at that time a very contemporary way of how we move forward, how he was moving forward. And yet at the same time you have artists today like Guillermo Cuitca, a painter from Argentina, Buenos Aires, who also has done a lot like this. He's done maps, but he's done maps of Eastern Europe where his parents were born and had to escape the Nazis. So, and now, you know, he did a whole series then of different major roads, historical roads. And so that the whole aspect, if we had a Cuitca to compare here, you would see that it's there. And there's nothing wrong with it. Cuitca is much more upfront about it, and Diebenkorn is not. But definitely there is that kind of similarity, and each of them are... Cuitca today, Diebenkorn in the past, trying to load up the paintings with specific information. And we may know a little bit about it, we may know what Diebenkorn has said in various interviews and in writings, but a lot of that's personal information. So we don't know the feelings when he made this, what he was thinking 100%, but they are charged paintings, and that there's this information that is in there because of these specific gestural notions and the way it's all styled. We go into next gallery here. So basically what we have here is, I mean, this is top Diebenkorn. I mean, if anybody at any museum or any institution, this is hanging, there's no mistaking this for any other work, basically because this is the zenith. This is for this series, this is, you know, top two for me. Basically because it, once again, the ocean, the landscape, the kind of layering, the verticality, the kind of still this map overlay or this construction architecture going on with the line, it doesn't really get any better for Diebenkorn than this. And this is the kind of work that a lot of artists in California were looking at. I think it changed people's lives because they were seeing what was coming from New York, abstract expressionism. They were seeing the color field happening in the 60s, early 60s, mid 60s. And it's funny that almost everybody outside of Rouché, who just also created his own world, but almost everybody from San Diego down from San Diego up to San Francisco, I apologize, really saw this as a starting point for them. If not the main marker, one of the markers. And it went much more rigid at the time because of this kind of structuring system, both with the forms and with the colors. It became much more rigid, much more geometric. Not that that wasn't happening in New York, it was, but I would say California really had its own kind of language and sense of iconography or signifiers for that quick reduction in the way line, shape, and color were used. And it really kind of then moved into even the 70s to a lot of the kind of post-minimalist work, such as John McCracken. This is the kind of work where I really see McCracken. Sure, he was influenced by Judd and by Tony Tassett and Tony DeLapp, but at the same time, definitely Diebenkorn. I mean, I don't know if you know the work by John McCracken, but basically he made a series of monochromatic plinths or planks that were basically colored, very glossy, very almost like surfboards, very slick, and they just leaned up against the wall. He also did a series of kind of the same sculptural treatment, in geometric forms that were on the wall or on the floor. And so this aspect of even sculptors who were at once painters because of artists such as Diebenkorn never really left painting. They made their sculptures extremely colorful, and they use non-traditional kind of materials such as fiberglass. Well, nobody up until that time used fiberglass, and so it's quite interesting to see this, along with, as I mentioned earlier, a variety of the geometric painters that really kind of took from Diebenkorn bits and pieces and then kind of mixed in their own personal language to create their bodies of work or their particular styles. It's truly amazing. Go on to the next space here. When the exhibit opened here in Fort Worth, I came the following weekend, and on this particular painting, I was amazed, and when you come up, on how many different layers exist and something he didn't hide. I mean, there's a red, a blue, a black, a white, and then this gray all underneath, and then he painted over it, and it's coming through in different kind of layers. And so the aspect of, I mean, he's painting like an impressionist. And so this whole aspect of the layering and the history just in, this particular area is pretty rich. And I'm sure there was a specific calculation, or maybe not to a certain extent, but there was definitely a work process happening here where, from top to bottom, the aspect of putting the work down, trying to create, be it this a field or a specific area of land or an abstraction in his own mind or a combination of all the above, it's something that he wanted really to create in a kind of very layered manner. And the aspect of the particular changes, the different marks, especially up there, is pretty evident. Also, something that isn't really talked a lot is that he also scraped a lot of paint off, as such as on top here. You can see that actually he took something, be it a brush or a piece of wood or whatever, and actually just scraped the paint off. And so that whole process of adding and subtracting was definitely part of that process. and the manipulation and the layering are the true story in these works. Back here there's a very similar piece. Very similar piece where you can see the different layering, the different coats, the subtraction happening. With both of these works and with others, you also see him being, I think, a little bit more generous with diluting the paint, so it becomes a little bit more even painterly, more of the emotional kind of component rather than just the geometric. But yet at the same time, you have this sharp geometric angle with the green. So it kind of creates this two-sided world where you have the emotional with the varnish or whatever he used, the alcohol to reduce the oil, and yet at the same time the geometry. And so he's playing with both, which is at that point kind of unheard of. I mean, either you're the geometric or you were, you know, very physical with the paint. You didn't do both, or very few did both. And so I think that's something that was very unique to Diebenkorn, and he was definitely ahead of his time in terms of that whole process of creating this duality in the work. And it's something, to be quite honest with you, that a lot of artists don't like. I mean, it's either you're in one camp or another. It's kind of like you're with me or against me. And I don't think Diebenkorn really cared. He was just doing what he enjoyed most and was most passionate about. But that's something that has always been written about, and that a lot of people didn't really associate with his work. Not that it wasn't good. They all agree it was amazing. But they didn't like this aspect of having these two, possibly three or even four simultaneous activities happening in the painting visually, that it was just too much. I don't necessarily agree upon that, but it's something that is discussed, especially writings in the critical writings in the 70s and 80s about his work. There were a few seminal museum exhibitions, and there were some interesting articles written about this whole aspect of his life and his painting styles. So really quite amazing. Go on to next gallery here. For me, Diebenkorn was always somebody who was always looking and actually never stopped looking at what other artists were doing. Even this painting from 1980, relatively late in his career, he was definitely going, and at this point, the museums in Los Angeles were able to get a series of seminal works from abstract expressionism, European painters, and I've always found it interesting on how a work like this, actually before this exhibit, I've never seen this piece before, but this for me is almost, you know, this still looking at abstract expressionism, still kind of thinking and mulling it over in the particular style. The palette has changed from the first gallery that we were in. Not dramatically, but it has changed, and the spaces have gotten quite larger. Especially when we see here, they've become the different geometric abstractions and forms have grown larger. They've become a little bit more distinct. The line is not necessarily tighter, but there is an absolute change and shift in this whole process of making these particular paintings. See here, it's very gradual. I mean, the nice thing about Diebenkorn is he really stuck with his particular style. The shift in the work and the work style was extremely gradual over the course of making this body of work. At the same time, before and after, he was very much involved in creating duality in also his studio practice, being sometimes a little more realistic in what he was producing, sometimes taking some time out to see what others were doing, and yet formulating a series of small writings about the context, the environment of his work. So it was, I think, and that especially that occurred in the late 60s and early 70s. And so I guess getting back to these particular works, there is a gradual shift in terms of the space. The blues are a little bit more muted than what we'd seen before. The changes that occur here are consistent, but yet at the same time, the language has changed. Much like, as mentioned before, in the very beginning, the time. It was all about, very much about time. And this whole aspect of time has shifted dramatically from when these works were started until this time, basically because the way he engaged himself with the landscape and an environment obviously changed itself. And so it's something that for me is quite interesting, and I keep on thinking about recycling for some reason. I don't know why, but I feel like there's some kind of a recycling process, not in his own work, but recycling some of those initial ideas that he had in the beginning of his career that were kind of maybe refined and focused more than ever. And he had the time to dwell, or maybe it was a pain in his head that, you know, after 10 years it became a bigger pain or less of a pain. And so somehow, like, we all change, be it very slowly. The works in Diebenkorn change, be it very slowly. And so for me, this is also quite nice in terms of the late paintings, because it is a little bit different. Along with that piece behind us there, it's the same, but yet it's different. It's the kind of thing where if you do have the time and the luxury, if you do take a look at that, then go to the first gallery, then come back and take a look at these, you'll notice those subtle changes. You'll notice the way things have changed up a bit. The lines, the forms, there isn't this need for extreme. It's become a little bit more casual. It's become a little bit more gentle in terms of the way the information is presented to us, which of course only, you know, growing older can do. And so I think that there is a nice balance, especially in the installation here, in the particular galleries going. And something we haven't really talked about, but a lot of the drawings are extremely important. For those of you who can, take a look at the drawings, because there's a lot of these strange, very nice nuances that he uses in the drawings, almost details to a certain extent from the larger paintings, which explain a lot. They explain the kind of the almost a fetish to a certain specific style or a shape or a form. And because the paintings are almost like books unto themselves. And here you have a few chapters of a few pages from a chapter, which you get more of an insight to the larger completed works. And so that's something not to be missed. At the same time, it's interesting because his career, just like many artists, you know, really, he was always important. He was always there. But it's somehow we always took it for granted that he's always going to be there. And unfortunately, when he died, it kind of changed a lot. I mean, it changed a lot in a way where it's that kind of comfort zone disappeared with Diebenkorn's work. Because he really pulled us through from the 50s all the way until the 80s, creating this language of California abstractionism or abstract painting that I think he was really taken for granted in the 70s and 80s, for sure, late 70s and early 80s, because everybody was looking for the new thing. You know, at that point, art became very much about trends and very much about styles and very much about the new. And Diebenkorn was never any of those things. He was just kind of doing his thing and creating his language and working in the studio. And, you know, obviously for me, it's the one thing I do like about Diebenkorn is that he got up every day and, like a machine, went to the studio and made art. I mean, it was just, it didn't stop. Up until he was hospitalized and then shortly afterward died. I mean, if he wasn't traveling, he was in the studio. He wasn't hanging out in a cafe like in Paris or, you know, taking a swim in the ocean, which I'm sure he did. So he didn't partake in the beach culture. He was a painter. And it was basically these ideas and the different languages that were in his head in terms of formulating his work and the compositions. He had to get it out, and the only way he could get it out is by going to the studio and kind of living those things out, be it on paper or in canvas. And so for me, it's really amazing to have a show like this, because it is very subtle. There is no wow, there's no flash, there's no, you know, anger here. It's really a story that's being told, a personal story. And sometimes it's nice, but it's, for a lot of people, it's also extremely unusual, because it's kind of like getting on a bus and having somebody next to you, and they start talking about something that happened that day. Like, you kind of want to know, but you don't want to know. And yet, at the same time, here we have this same thing happening with Diebenkorn. It's like he's telling us the story, and we see it. We kind of like it. But yet, at the same time, it takes us a while to really pull out the information beyond just a casual breeze walk by. So, an exhibit of this magnitude, there's a lot of information, a lot. And I would say more so than even, as we were discussing earlier, those abstract expressionists. When you go to the Rothko Chapel in Houston, you know, you see these works, they're very gigantic. Yes, it's very emotional because it was his last works. But it kind of, you know, once you rise to a certain level in terms of that, yes, the architecture is also, you know, kind of amazing and set up for that. Once you reach a certain plateau, you know, yes, it enlightens you, it takes you to a certain level, but that information has a beginning and an end. Here with Diebenkorn, we really don't get all of the ending part. And I think that's important to say, is that there's just too much information in that layering process, in the color abstraction, in the forms itself, that you can't, it's not your the voice in your head doesn't shut off. As with Rothko, you could shut the voice off in your head, which is amazing, because then you're really meditating. But yet at the same time with Diebenkorn, you can't shut the voice off in your head, because there's too many resolved issues. There's too many questions in each canvas. There's too much of him that's in there that you can't figure out why is it happening and what and why that particular day and why that particular shape and why in this canvas. It actually asks more questions than it answers compared to even a Pollock. Where Pollock, yes, there's a million dots of color. There's, you know, the splashes go in every way. But it's very, you know, there it was very much about a different kind of a work style. But there's a beginning and an end. What I like about this show is that you'll be leaving here saying, yes, what a great visual experience, but then a lot of questions won't be answered. And that is significant work. And that's the one thing that, you know, seeing the work now over and over again, that's, I think, the real trump card for Diebenkorn in terms of compared to his contemporaries of that time. Yes.
Although I'm not aware of your comment on it, would this be a little bit this different configuration of proportion in the geometrics? Don't you think that you could have been influenced by color field aspect of abstraction expression when seeing these larger?
Oh, for sure, absolutely, absolutely, and I think the color field, he doesn't fit into a mold. I mean, he didn't fit into color field. He didn't really fit into abstract expressionism. He completely was anything that was happening in New York in the '60s, much less, not even in the same ballpark as pop or minimalism or any of those kind of scenarios. So I think He created his own vocabulary, and I think he felt very comfortable with that. Yes, he borrowed from everything, but yet at the same time, I think he felt very comfortable living in his own bubble or his own island. Once again, no different than Rouchet. I mean, Rouchet right now, if somebody asked me what Rouchet is, I would say Rouchet is Rouchet. I mean, it's like there's, you know, he's onto his own. There's no connection really. And he's also created his own world. And there are many artists around the world like that. But I think the nature of our country and the history of specifics, be it East Coast or West Coast, I think in the West Coast, up until the 1980s, you could do that. You really could kind of really isolate yourself and focus in on your work, which I think is sadly disappearing. There's also, you know, a lot of people did that in northern New Mexico too, in Santa Fe. They gravitated to light, they gravitated to an area to work, to also be isolated and create their own. So there have been pockets around this country and around the world on how these kind of phenomena happens. But what I think is quite unusual is that he was basically in a suburb of a large metropolitan area when he created these works, and he was able to restrict himself and to focus and keep focused on creating these paintings. Yes? That I don't know. Yeah? No, I think I was talking more of an isolation, studio isolation. I mean, once again, even though he's an avid museum goer, you know, it's actually quite different to come back from your studio and to pick up right where you left off. So, yeah. Yes. Right. 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 Well, I think it's almost like there were. It's funny because if we could compare just to one artist, Rothko, there's the beginning and the end. And there's this level of shutting the voice off in the viewer's, his own mind, and the viewer's own mind, to reach a higher level. But yet at the same time, he bought so much into an ideology, which was abstract expressionism, which you cannot have ideology and this level of you know, higherness. And yet at the same time, Diebenkorn had zero ideology, didn't buy into anything that anybody else was doing, but yet filled the paintings and the drawings up with completely unresolved kind of issues and these notions of, this is what I'm thinking today. And actually, to a certain extent, you know, I can throw out there, he's almost like the first post-conceptual artist, where even though he was not conceptualism, but post-conceptual artists are, you know, conceptual artists that add something personal to the thinking process of their studio today. And so it's actually very contemporary, where once again, the works are not related to readings, the works are not related to kind of a dialogue in terms of literary or other artistic information, but yet at the same time, they are contemporary. That's what I'm trying to say. That there, if he was alive today, the work would very be in the notion of what younger artists are trying to achieve. Yes. Exactly.
So, to me, it seems very. There is mystery, there's tension, there's unresolved issues. That's how I.
Right. Right. Sure.
So, I've never seen this much work together.
Yeah, it's great.
This big, large piece is amazing.
Yeah.
So, I just.
No, absolutely.
Historically, we understand. I mean, there is this question of historically, there is documentation of the relationship between Francis.
That I'm not an expert on this series, so I don't know, but...
Yes.
Are there any other questions I can answer? But at the same time, the reason why Roscoe killed himself was because of the voices in his head. So, it's everything's unresolved. Well, thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
I'm sorry that I got...